Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with iconic actor Sam Elliott. Sam Elliott spent a lot of time outdoors as a kid, hiking and fishing with the men he admired most, his dad and his dad's hardworking buddies. Elliott Sr. was proud of Sam's trout-catching prowess, but didn't think he had a snowball's chance in hell of becoming an actor. But Sam never doubted it. He knew he'd be an actor simply because he was determined to roll up his sleeves and go gunning for it. His strength was the same no-nonsense acting that made icons of the men he admired most. Guys like Gary Cooper, Jimmy Stewart, and John Wayne. It's no surprise he's become indelibly linked with range riders, cowpokes, and lawmen. Sam's always made acting look easy, even when he's doing it on an out-of-control horse while shooting a rifle and flinging lines over his shoulder to a camera. He says no one would ever mistake him for Daniel Day-Lewis, but I suspect Sam's simplicity is deceptive. I'd be content to watch him do westerns and nothing else, but these days, Hollywood's come gunning for him. At 72, he's taking on acclaimed indie dramas like Grandma and I'll See You in My Dreams, and acting in TV series like Justified and his Netflix comedy, The Ranch. But I was most excited to ask him about The Hero, a new film written just for him. Watching it, I realized it could have never been written for anyone else. In this episode, you'll hear tales of old Hollywood, the Old West, and new roles. You'll hear about the case of mistaken identity that led to his breakout film and why he torpedoed it. I also tried to get him to explain that famous line from The Big Lebowski. You know the one I'm talking about. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for coming and doing this.
I'm honored to see you again. And
well, we met a long time ago, briefly,
in a trailer. So long, we can't even decide which what was the truth about
that's
when
right.
we met.
Well, I'm about to blow your mind because that wasn't the first time we met. And when I found out you were coming on this show, I got very excited because my first ever experience on a film set was with you. My cousin is the great Crewe Chamberlain, sound man of film and commercials, and he did Mask. So when I was 16 years old, he said, you can come out and spend the day on set and see what it's like. And it was the day you were filming the scene at the graveyard.
You've got to be kidding me.
And I went out and I, you know, sat by his cart and I watched everything. And then at lunch, I ate a big giant lunch and I came back to the cart and promptly fell asleep after lunch. I woke up and I said, hey, Crewe, what does sound speed mean? And the director, cut. And I had ruined a take.
Perfect.
So I've had you on to apologize.
You got your, well, no need.
So that was my first film experience.
Wow.
And when I was reading about you for this, I read that you initially almost turned that down.
It was a funny thing. It was a matter of timing and logistics. And it had to do with my wife as well. We were in Hawaii getting married. I got a call from my agent at the time. I wanted to come and meet me on this film. And I said, what the fuck, man? I'm on my vacation. I'm on my honeymoon. Anyway, went back and told Catherine, you got to go to the office to use a phone over there in those days. Anyway, unbeknownst to me, she goes and calls back and tells, no worry, I'll get him there. And
really?
Yeah. So we left a couple of days early, and I got the meeting. And
I think that's a good example of this business in general, and I've certainly experienced it throughout my life, of you can never really plan a vacation or count on having
anything.
Any sort of normal schedule. And I wonder about your relationship with saying no to projects, and if you've gone through some sleepless nights wondering if you've made the right decision on certain things.
I think I do that more now than ever.
Really?
Because I find it's harder to leave home now.
Right.
Catherine misses me more than she did when she was a kid. It's like, yeah, right, go ahead. And I miss being home.
Yeah.
And I think because for whatever reason, because I'm busy now, busier than I've ever been the last couple of years.
Yeah.
That downtime is more important to me than ever. I don't mean I'm tired all the time, but if I fall asleep in a minute, it's not the company.
We'll continue it. But I think that's...
I don't second guess myself once I commit to something. It takes me time to commit to something.
Right.
But I've got myself boxed in this year between the ranch and Star is Born and doing press for Hero. I'm going to do another film in August. It's going to take the whole month. Then it's going to be back to the ranch, like, right away. So.
God. Well, I would think that all this work is so good, too, that it would be hard to say no because you're having these last few years with these great directors, these great parts. And is that sort of a funny thing to you to be so busy and not wanting to leave home, but at the same time, how do you say no to these opportunities?
Yeah, it's the catch-22.
Yeah.
One of several.
Yeah.
But that's definitely one of them.
Yeah.
You know? But it's, you know, I'm doing what I wanted to do when I was a little kid, so lucky me.
Well, this movie, The Hero, it's you and Brett Haley who directed the film, and he says, Sam Elliott is my definition of a man.
It's a bit of a stretch.
Well, you know, it certainly is.
It makes you wonder what kind of guys Brett's been hanging around with, including his dad and his brother.
but, you know, you've, for lack of a better term, you've reached this stage of iconic, you know, your career straddled two eras, the studio system and the independent era, and now we're into whatever we're here now, the golden age of television or whatever. But, you know, you have done a significant number of roles that are in that vein of, you know, the biker, the cowboy, or
of being a man.
And and it made me wonder what that definition is for you.
I think that men have generally been softened.
Well, how does that feel to you?
I can only speak of the men that were in my life. And that was my dad and his friends. Those are the men that I recall.
Right.
Those are the men that I grew up going fishing and, you know, spending time with.
Yeah.
I had friends, certainly, but the men in my life were my dad's friends. And they were all pretty hardcore. They were gentlemen. I mean, they weren't assholes. They were nice men, but they were hardcore. They were hardworking men.
What did your dad do?
He worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service.
So he was outside all the time?
Yep.
And did he take you around?
He took me a lot of places.
Really?
I grew up in Sacramento. I was born and raised in Sacramento. My family's all from West Texas. And he was an easy period. He died at 54 years old. Had a heart attack. Boom. Gone.
Really?
Died in my mom's arms on our living room floor in Portland, Oregon.
How old were you?
18. I was away. I was at school. I was down in Eugene going to U of O at the time.
God.
That was a bummer.
And were you...
My dad died thinking I was a total idiot for wanting to be an actor.
Really?
Yeah. My mom supported it from day one. Since I was a little kid, she always encouraged me to do the creative thing.
So did that drive a wedge between...
My dad thought I was a fucking idiot for it. You know?
He did?
Yeah. No, it didn't drive a wedge. He just thought I was an idiot for it.
What did he say, you know?
He said, you got a snowball's chance in hell of having a fucking career in that town.
And did that motivate you?
All. Sure.
Like, did you want to prove, even after he died, were you still proving something to him?
I never thought about it as trying to have a need to prove something to him other than I wanted him to be proud of me. So, you know, that's the worst part of it, you know, or when you don't think your dad's proud of you, that's a fucking, you know. I knew that he was in other areas, you know. He knew I could catch more trout than he or any of his friends.
Really?
He was proud of that. But I don't think he ever got the theater arts interest.
Did he ever get to see you perform?
Yeah, he came a couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah. But that is a defining thing to have a father that you look up to as a man who didn't get to see you
succeed.
Find your footing
succeed.
And succeed. Yeah.
Incredible. Disappointment on some level.
I would imagine.
You know.
So talk about how you, once you made this decision, you're going to go give this a shot. Because you had been raised by him with that kind of work ethic and with that you know, that idea in your mind that he doesn't believe you can do it. Did you give yourself any sort of rules or limits?
Parameters when
parameters
I came
of
here.
Oh, I'm going to give this a shot.
X amount of time.
Yeah.
No. I'm going to go down here and do it. I had tunnel vision, man. I had tunnel vision since I was, you know. I think my first recollection of wanting to be an actor, a movie actor, not a legitimate actor.
Is that a difference for you?
To me, it's a considerable difference. Yeah, I mean, I have the greatest respect for people that go on stage and do the stuff that we do for movies. Love to have done some of it, but I think that time has come and gone, you know. The
wow.
idea of getting up and doing a play now would probably terrify me.
Would it really?
Yeah. I'm not sure I could remember that much dialogue. But I had tunnel vision since I was a kid about doing this, so, you know. I never thought that I wasn't going to come down here and do something.
What initially turned you on?
Going to too many movies. I went to a place called the Sequoia Theater in Sacramento, California. I used to go to Saturday matinees and see Westerns, see all those Flash Gordon, you know, deals, you know.
See, I find that interesting that your dad worked for the Department of the Interior and, mm-hmm. and you had such an outdoorsy life, and so you were drawn to Westerns.
I think that's part of that whole Western heritage that I've got coming. Man, I've got, you know, grandfathers, great-grandfathers that were lawmen that were shot in the street in Giddings, Texas.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But, yeah, the Western heritage thing is real and alive and well in me and still is, you know.
You know, it's interesting. This new film, The Hero,
mm-hmm.
you play a guy who is known for this role in a movie called The Hero.
Right.
And it was sort of your career pinnacle achievement.
Right.
And when we meet you, you're diagnosed with cancer, and you're being given a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Right.
And so throughout the film, there's these memory or dream sequences where we're taken back into the experience
right.
of making this film.
Right.
And what I read that was so interesting is that Brett said, the director and writer, said that he wrote the script based upon conversations he had with you mm-hmm. on a previous film where you guys went out and did a press junket.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know as you were talking that he was sort of...
No.
Do you recall those conversations?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it was just, you know, I'll See You in My Dreams. It was a press junket for that. We went back and forth across the country a couple of times and spent a lot of time together, sitting next to each other on airplanes, having meals together, having drinks together. You know, we got to know each other and like each other. I think Brett and I really, truly like each other. We certainly have a lot of respect for each other, but I think we're close. And we got close then. So when you get close to people and you open up to them, then odds are you're going to say something that provokes somebody's thinking.
That's the filmmaker quality,
so
right?
So he got this idea and, you know, for whatever reason, it was, you know, fleshed out with this dialogue of mine. And a lot of it was pretty personal with this story. And when I first got this treatment, it was called Iceberg.
Really?
Yeah. And the money people wanted to change the title because they didn't think that Iceberg was marketable as a title. I wanted to call it The Hero. Which, God, seemed like a weird title. That's not a title that I wanted my name attached to.
Yeah, well, you're in every frame of the film, and
I know.
There it is.
I know.
But it makes
all the more reason.
It makes total sense,
though. The iceberg theory was so provocative. You know, is what you see what's really there? Is that what's really important?
Is the iceberg...
The top eighth, or is it the 7/8 underneath the surface that... Where all the good shit is.
Right.
Or the real shit.
Is that what the film's about to you?
Sure.
I think there's themes about remorse.
Yeah.
And aging.
Yeah.
And obviously mortality.
Yeah.
When you get a project like this and you have to dig into this person, is it more that you try to create a character or is it more that you try to find all the ways you're already like this guy?
I didn't have to dig anything. I just had to remember my lines and go to work.
Because it was really written about your life.
I've never had a script written for me before. I mean, I think that's, if this was it, I'd be happy. I feel like I've got somewhere in my 48 years or whatever it's been. And it's good enough.
Right.
And it's got to be some sort of a dream for an actor to have an entire screenplay written for him.
Yeah. So how close is that guy to you?
He's close on some levels. I think when he gets the award and that speech that he gives,
right,
I think that's absolutely from my heart.
Okay,
I'm no better than you, and you're no better than me. It just happens to be what I do for a living. I'm an actor.
Right.
I don't deserve this award any more than you do. Awards are a weird thing. They're a weird thing. What does it say about you?
Right, and I think for people who haven't seen the film, you actually bring someone up from the audience and sort of try to put the credit on her. And
give her the credit.
Yeah, give her the credit because she's a human being.
She's a human being.
Yeah.
And so we're all in this shit together.
Right, and it only serves to make you sort of more interesting.
Yeah, it goes viral.
Right.
Which the character hadn't got a clue what viral means.
Right.
Which is kind of like me, actually. There's certain things about it that are like me and certain things. There's like four things that are not like me. One of them's the tenuous relationship with the daughter. I'm like that with my daughter. The divorced wife. I'm like that with Catherine. 39 years we've been together. We've been married 33 years. The cancer diagnosis.
Well, thank God for that.
And there's one more.
The drugs, probably.
The drugs, the dope smoking.
Right. I think people will think you're a pothead when this comes out.
Probably.
But, you know, you look at throughout your films, there's a lot of smoking going on. Like, you're obviously very good as an actor at smoking on camera.
Yeah, Brett wanted me to be smoking through a bong, and he had all these accoutrements and all this shit, man. And I just said, hey, man, really? You know, I can't smoke in a bong. I've tried it, and it choked me out every time I've ever done it, you know. And I said, I can appreciate the visual of the smoke and the tube and all that, but just let me roll some joints.
Okay, and that brings up a good question. When the script comes to you, I'm sure there's a tendency to say, I see where you're going with this, but let me make this more real for you and more true to me. And you would have more, I would think.
I think on some level that in my career, I've spent a lot of time worrying about script and made a lot of people either angry, probably along the way.
Really?
Yeah, because it's not an actor's place to go and rewrite a script. You know, and there's been a couple of instances where I didn't want to leave it alone. I did a movie called The Quick and the Dead one time.
Yeah.
It was a Louis L'Amour book. I'd done Louis L'Amour before this one.
Yeah.
The Sacketts. And I'd made a deal with this guy that was producing the movie. The father of the guy that was on set producing. Names will remain nameless. And I was down working in Texas. I was doing the Sam Houston thing. And I got a call about this script from this producer who was in New York. And he said, we're going to fix it. We're talking about the fix it. You know, it was what you just said, but this is well before production. And they were going to fix the screenplay. This movie went right after the Sam Houston. I was going to go from there to New Mexico and start this job.
Okay.
Got up there. They handed me a new script. It was the same script. And I made a deal with this guy. It was like hinged me going on this job, hinged on that script being brought back to Louis's book.
Okay.
I'd gone totally afield from Louis's book. So I spent the rest of the show rewriting pages on this script and sticking them under it had a deadline or a timeline under the director's door at night. The AD who I'd had greatest respect for and worked with a number of times ended up hating me by the end of the movie. I think probably because of Kate or because of a relationship that she had, probably the word went out in a couple of quarters that I just assumed it didn't go out to, that I was a real pain in the ass, that I was rewriting the script and all this bullshit. which I was doing.
But that's the dilemma.
But it had to do with a commitment that, you know, made me get involved with the project in the beginning, and I just held the guy to it. I mean, the ideal world, and, you know, I mean, yeah, I can appreciate going and working for somebody that has such a clear vision and is totally in control of every frame. And, you know, I've always felt that I'm there to service the director, period. He's the guy I'm working for. I want to do what I can. He's the master. He's the captain of the ship. He's the one, you know, standing at the helm. I'm a crew. I'm on the crew. I want to help him get from where he's going to where he wants to get.
But I think what you bring up is the exact dilemma when you understand material really well and you mm-hmm. sign on because there's a promise attached to it. I mean, I guess the question there is, would you rather be difficult and make better art or...
roll over for it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd rather be a pain in the ass and make better art. Because I think that's, you know, on some level. Because if you get a bad reputation, if you get a bad rap going around you, that's like the death knell.
I think you're okay at this
point.
People
aren't going to be hiring if you're a pain in the ass. And I've tried not to ever be a pain in the ass. I've not gone out of my way ever to be a pain in the ass.
Right. But thinking about the way you were raised
mm-hmm.
and being a strong, opinionated person with a work ethic,
mm-hmm.
you're going to run into conflicts in a business that...
No question.
You know what I mean? And I don't know how you do. I think that's one of the hardest things that no one talks about is the management of relationships within a creative collaborative field.
Yeah. It's not easy sometimes. But I find the most creative people that I've had an opportunity to work with are the easiest ones to work with on some level. Because when they recognize that you're as keen as they are to doing the job, to being as creative as possible, to making it as good as it can be, it's a wonderful relationship.
They're not afraid.
Then they have no reason to be.
Right.
I think being honest and opinionated is a difficult thing. And I've been quoted many times in my early on in my career that I was not only honest and opinionated, but I wasn't very smart.
Really?
And that's a lethal combination.
But do you agree with that?
Yeah, probably.
You do?
Yeah.
Smart. You got smarter as you went on.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, when you're a kid...
You learn the road. I mean, you find the road. If you're on it long enough, you discover how to stay on it.
Before we get off the hero, I want to ask you about... The scene that really got me in the film involves an audition. As an audience member, you get the power.
That's everybody's favorite scene.
Oh, my God.
Well, not everybody's, but that's the scene most people single out.
It's so powerful to see you come to life and show all your power as an actor in that rehearsal with Nick Offerman for the eventual audition. And as an audience member, you're like, oh, yeah, his career is going to.
Yeah, it had to happen there, though. It had to happen.
But then you come in to the audition and nothing works, and
the reality of the game. It's the reality of it.
But it's like watching a man with integrity and morals and a work ethic, and your biggest concern is that you've wasted their time, and it's such a heartbreak of a scene. And of course, watching that, I have to wonder, you know, if you've had an experience like that that makes you question the very reason you're acting or what you're doing, if those kinds of feelings can still come up after doing it this long.
It's been a long time since I read for anything.
Well, what did you draw on for that?
It's not my favorite thing.
Right. Well, I can't imagine.
Now, I'll tell you, number one, it's one of the worst pieces of writing that Brett Haley ever did. I give him credit for that, too. The audition scene I'm talking about. It's really ridiculous.
And it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
For that character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was that, making not very good stuff believable. But it was important because of the failure that he was going to confront in the audition scene to do it well in the rehearsal, to see that it could be real.
Right.
With Nick Offerman reading the part of the daughter.
And Nick tears up.
And he did tear up. there were a lot of tears on the set that day, man. And it was one of those moments that nobody figures, oh, this is going to be a fucking dramatic scene. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right.
You know, this follows a series of one-liners from Offerman. You steal fax, you know?
Yep.
I'm waiting for the agent to send it over the fax machine. And I'm on the phone with the agent saying, really? They want me to read? I haven't read in 40 years, man.
Right.
Yeah, it was just one of those moments that, you know, sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't. And they happen at the strangest times and places. You know, we rehearsed it, I think, once and then started doing it. And we did it only a couple of times. And it was like, wow, it was powerful. It was powerful.
Is acting still mysterious enough to you even after this long that when something like that happens, it sort of renews
mysterious
you?
Mysterious and wonderful. It's like wonderful. That's the goal. That's when those unsuspected things come. I mean, you can go in and you think, oh, boy, this is such a great scene. How can we fuck this up? But sometimes you can. And then sometimes out of the worst stuff comes the best stuff.
Yeah.
It's not only what's on the page. And I've always believed in the adage, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. You know, I've said that a million times, too, and I know people are sick of hearing it from me. But I believe that. That said, it's more than, you know, it's the sum total. It's just one of the parts, the page.
Yeah.
It's the people, you know, the relationship that you make. And, you know, I remember more about relationships, and I'm more thankful for the relationships and friendships over the years than the work somehow.
Do you think when an audience feels an emotion collectively, do you think that for an actor to be able to transmit or transfer that to an audience, do you have to also feel it?
Yeah, where else would the audience get it from? If the actor doesn't feel it, then where are they going to? They're not going to make it up or interpret something differently than was the way it's portrayed. I think you just got to be honest. You got to be as honest as you can. I think that over the years that I've become comfortable enough with the process that it's easier for me to be honest in the work. I think that was one of the things that always got me about, it's like the Louis L'Amour thing. It wasn't fucking real. It wasn't honest. It wasn't true to Louis L'Amour.
And when it starts in that non-honest place, it nothing else can follow, correct?
It didn't follow.
Well, you started when the whole system of Hollywood was very different. Like, you started in the studio system.
Still
where
still have the contract programs. There were two that were active, and one was at Universal, one was at Fox. I was in the one at Fox, and it was basically based on nepotism and girlfriends and boyfriends, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm not sure how I fit into it, but I had an agent, my first agent, and it was one of the first meetings that he took me on, a guy named Dick Bassman, who's dead now. And he took me to meet a woman named Lillian Gallo at Fox, who's also dead now. And she worked for a guy named Jack Bauer, who's also dead now. And I auditioned for them and then auditioned for Dick Zanuck, who's also dead now, and got accepted into the program.
So we should say, for people who don't understand, that you weren't auditioning for a film. You were auditioning for a contract. And that's how it worked.
$85 a week is what it paid. I
really?
Was paying $85 a month rent. And I lived right out the back gate on Tennessee, right out the back gate of Fox.
Did it seem simpler then that you could just
It was simpler. Are you kidding me?
What was the first time when you felt like, okay, I'm in, I've made it? I mean, was that...
When I signed my contract to Fox.
That was enough for
sure,
you?
Sure, man. I was a professional actor. As soon as I started getting paid, right, for being an actor, then I'd achieve my goal. I mean, it wasn't about being a movie star. It wasn't about making money. It wasn't about anything more than making film or television.
Right.
You know, and I worked a little bit. Most kids under the contract didn't work. Tom Selleck and I worked more than the others. Tom and I both started there at the same exact time. He was fresh out of SC, and I was fresh out of Oregon. So, you know, pretty much the same time. And there were two women that were, I've had more women involved in my world than anything in terms of helping me through the trenches, so to speak. There were two women I met one time that worked in the legal department at Fox in the administration building, who I befriended on the way to Zanuck's office or something one time.
I just imagine you and Tom Selleck walking around and these women in the...
Yeah, with no mustaches.
With no mustaches.
Right.
How do you like that?
It was a fun time.
I bet it was.
It was a fun time. And that's why I say, when did you know that... It's just that that was the time. That was the beginning. And I don't think there was ever more fun to be had than that period of time.
Isn't that true that when you're starting out and you're new in something,
yeah,
and the whole thing's in front of you, that really is the best of times.
It is the best of it, because you finally got your toe in there. You know, these two women, I want to finish that thought, worked in the legal department. They were surrounded by scripts. Scripts first go to the legal department before they go to casting, before they go to anywhere, because they read them and they're looking for any kind of legal issues. And these girls said, "We have all these scripts here. You're welcome to come anytime and look at them."
Really?
And I went and saw the script before the casting people saw them. And I would call to the casting people or go down and sit in their office and wait for a minute. And I'd say, "There's a script coming. It's number so-and-so, and this is the title of it, for Judge for the Defense or Felony Squad or whatever it is. And there's a part in there, and I would really love to come read for it." And I got jobs doing,
you know what,
I got jobs doing that.
I fully believe that if you dig deep enough into anyone's success story, there's a little advantage that they found that they exploited that was sort of unique to their story.
Yeah.
And that was yours.
It's that work ethic. That's one of the things my dad taught me. Always do more, even if it's just a little more. Always do a little more than it's expected of you.
Right.
You know, that's a good... That's a good thing to live by.
God, it's amazing, you know? It's notable to point out how different it was than it is now.
Different world.
To have a contract and be getting paid, though you're not on a specific film, is such a different approach.
And the other thing about being on those contracts, I mean, in theory, contract players made the studios money because your salary didn't change.
Right.
When you went to work, I was still going to be making $85 a week or whatever it was.
And do you remember when that ended?
It was 3 years after I got into it.
So it was you were on the tail end of the contract.
I was the last one that was there. There was one lady, Linda Harrison, who was married to Dick Zanuck, that was there after we all disappeared.
And then everything changed.
Not long after that.
Well, we should talk about Lifeguard, because I feel like that was sort of the time when the studio system was sort of ending, and it sort of felt like an early independent film. And the thing is fascinating about this film is that it's such a time capsule of what America was on the brink of, the idea in the 70s of happiness comes from the simple things and family, and and it's right on the brink of that, and happiness comes from having more and more and more and status and Porsches and art galleries, and that if you're not ambitious, you're not happy, or there's something wrong with you if you're not ambitious. And the basic premise is you're a lifeguard, you're a little older than the other lifeguards. You live this life, you love your hours, you love your job location, you can pay your bills, and life's pretty good. And you sort of have this crisis of confidence that somehow, you know, people are telling you life is passing you by and you should really go after the bigger, ambitious thing. And it's sort of a subversive film in that way. And I guess what I wondered about when you were making that, if you were aware at the time of that message and that it wasn't a conventional film by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, how aware were you of that, of the whole like crisis of conscious thing that was going on in the character?
I don't think I've ever had anybody put it in that light that you just did, as well as you put it there.
Really?
It's not anything that I was not aware of. I took that serious. I took that guy being a lifeguard serious.
Yeah.
Consider what you just said about the film. And then recall the marketing campaign.
Right. Well, I'll let you describe the poster.
The poster was an animated poster. It was me in a pair of Speedos, looking really buffed. I was in shape. That was the best shape I'd been in maybe in my life on that movie. I was 30 years old. And there was a big busted girl on either arm.
Right.
In these little skimpy bikinis. There wasn't a big busted girl in the movie.
But what was the slogan on the poster? I forget.
Every girl's summer dream.
Right, right.
So I go out on the road on a press junket. In those days, you had press packets, press kits. Like they were that thick, you know, full 8x10 photos and untold storylines, synopsises,
right.
Bios on the, you know, one city, one night, take off, go to another city the next night. Invariably, I'd walk in and sit down and have an interview with somebody, and the first thing out of an interviewer's mouth was, "This movie is nothing like I expected it to be."
Which, yeah, it looks like.
And boy, that's all they had to say to me.
Yeah.
And I'd fucking be honest, opinionated, and not very smart. And I'd agree with them, and I'd say, "Yeah, it's too fucking bad, isn't it? You know, I mean, how can they come up with a campaign like this? It has nothing to do with what we were doing." I think I worked for Paramount for 30 years after that.
Like, what early lesson did that give you about the business?
I knew that I blew an opportunity. It was the first time I really had, you know, I'd played the leading man before, but it was, you know, in a Western with Vera Miles. And it was an opportunity that I didn't, because of being glib and honest and so forth, didn't really take full advantage of, I don't think. I'm not sure I was ready for it.
And ready to be like a marketing tool for,
yeah. Now
for
I
the studios.
I can negotiate it.
Right.
I can negotiate it now.
Yeah, it's funny you say it wasn't smart.
I was just being honest about it. And I'd sit down with these people that were intelligent reviewers, if there's such a thing.
Yeah.
And they had exactly the same reaction, but they weren't on the set. It was all based upon the press kit, all based upon the advertising.
God, I would think that'd be such a funny position for you to be in, because on one hand, you're the star of this film. And
it was very strange.
You know, this big tour, and then you're like, yeah, I'm as upset about it as you are.
It was very strange.
Well,
let me tell you something about Lifeguard. It was handled by the William Morris office at the time, and I couldn't get a meeting on it.
On Lifeguard?
Yeah. Both of my parents were lifeguards in El Paso, Texas. I was a lifeguard in Portland, Oregon. I was living on the beach with this buddy of mine, and I knew about this thing. And I was in the water every day, and I was in peak shape. The last time that I was in that kind of condition. And I couldn't get a meeting on this movie. And I finally just gave up on it and thought, well, fuck. Remember this agent telling me they don't want to meet you. They're honest, and, you know, they don't want to meet you. Okay. One day I get a call, totally out of the blue, from this agent at William Morris. He said, "Guess what? They want to meet you for Lifeguard." I said, "Really? Cool. How'd that happen?" "Oh, I don't know. They just called. They want to meet you."
So what happened?
This is the reason that I got the interview.
Yeah.
The night before I went in to meet with him, Dan Petrie, the director, and his wife, Dorothea, were getting ready for bed. Danny's in brushing his teeth in the bathroom, and Dorothea is laying on a bed looking at this movie called Frogs, in which I acted, and a gentleman named Adam Rourke was also in it. Dorothea says, "Danny, come look at this guy, Adam Rourke. He's perfect for the part." He said, "I know Adam Rourke, he's not right." She said, no, come here, he is. So Danny finishes brushing his teeth, comes into the room, and he said, "That's not Adam Rourke." She says, "Well, who is it?" He says, "I don't know. They sat through this fucking movie." I say fucking movie, but, you know, thank you very much, American International. Joan Van Ark was the leading lady in Frogs. So they sat through the movie, got my name off the credits. Adam was in it, but I wasn't Adam. And they found out who my agent was the next day and called, and that's how I got to meet him. Dan Petrie's wife.
No kidding.
Dorothea, dear Dorothea.
That's funny.
Yep.
Well, God, you know, it's just to put a point on that whole lifeguard thing, I feel like maybe that was a great opportunity to be in a situation where you were mismarketed, and it gave you a chance to look at how it shouldn't be done. Like, that can be as good of a lesson as seeing how it should be done,
I think all that's a learning experience.
Yeah.
If you're open to it, to learning, you got to learn. You got to be open to learning. I mean, life is it's a big long lesson.
Yeah.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, hopefully it's long if you're lucky.
If you keep making the same mistake over and over again, then it's a short road.
Yeah.
And all I wanted was the long road. That's all I really wanted, Sam, when I got in this business.
You never wanted to be really
famous. It wasn't about money. It wasn't about stardom. It wasn't about anything other than work. And I knew from the get-go, and it was why I was a pain in the ass about material, there was a certain kind of stuff that I wanted to do, and that's it.
What do you think made you realize that so young, that it wasn't about money for you?
My life wasn't about money. Not lower middle class, but boy, right on the cusp of it is the way I grew up.
Yeah, you bring up a point, which is that there's a temptation there that a lot of actors succumb to, that it sounds like you didn't, and maybe that was your work ethic or your father growing up, because I would think some people who came up dirt poor would really value money and really would do things for the money.
Maybe. I just always thought you had to work for money. And there's a kind of a, you know, I mean, it's a kind of embarrassment of riches now, but it's not in my hands. I've got people negotiating deals for me now. It's not like somebody says, okay, I'll pay you this for that. This is your job. I remember driving home. I used to pick my dad up. I worked for a packing warehouse in Portland, United Grocers, and I was unloading boxcars that went into this big warehouse. And I used to pick my dad and a buddy of his up at work for a while, for about a year. And I remember one time on a Friday picking him up, and I'd tossed my paycheck up on top of the dashboard. My dad said, can I look at that? And he looked at that, opened it up, and he said, you're making more money than I am.
Really?
Yeah, working for the federal government for 30 years at that point, you know.
Well, that must have been weird for your dad.
Yeah, I didn't like that at all.
Yeah.
That made me feel terrible.
And that was before you started acting. That was...
Oh, yeah. It was in school.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, in all my reading I did about you, there was clearly a period in your life where you were only getting sort of that. You really got typecast as the Western icon. Yeah. And when you work in a form like that, and you work in the Western, to make a good one, it is an extremely satisfying thing to see a good Western. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching Conagher the other night, and it's kind of the quintessential Western.
Yeah, it is.
It is, you know, you play a cowpuncher, right? You do cattle drives. And so in this film, there's a lot of riding you do. And in this film, you have to shoot a rifle while on a horse. You have to, like, drive cattle. And while you're doing all this, you have to turn around and hit your mark and deliver these great over-the-shoulder lines. And I was just watching it, the skill you have on a horse on that film. And
I rode on that horse, on that show. I rode a lot on that show.
And you're galloping at times, too.
Yeah,
you're moving.
Sure.
Do you have memories of experiences of learning how to specifically ride to be on camera? And
I just remember working hard on it. You know, we'd get out in a round pen, and I'd ride a number of different horses before we're, you know, rather than getting comfortable with one.
Oh, really?
I think you're asking me if I ever fell off of a horse, basically, is what you're most curious about. And I'll tell you.
Now I am.
I'll tell you. You know, there was a, back to this, the Vera Miles thing.
Right.
There was a time we were out in White Sands National Monument in New Mexico, beautiful part of the world. and we're riding this horse called Pie. He was John Wayne's horse, a big red horse with a white face. I believe we were both bareback. At least I want to tell myself that, because this horse got in, we got into a situation where horses, some horses, the thing about movie horses, you got to get them really comfortable around equipment, particularly in those days when they were using arc lights still, those great big things with a flame inside of them, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And cables everywhere and shiny boards and, you know, all kinds of booms, you know? In those days, big booms to get out over you to get the sound. All that kind of stuff can make a horse blow up. And I got on this horse one time, and I don't know what was eating this guy, because Wayne had worked on him a lot. And Wayne was more of a horseman than I was, certainly at that period of time, for sure. And we came in, and this horse just started spinning around, and Vera went off, and she just took me with her. You know, centrifugal force, and this horse is just going around in circles, and I felt her start to go, and I said, hang on, Vera, hang on, and then went next, and I knew I was just sitting at her, looking at her. We were sitting next to each other on our asses, and Pi was up there with a big smile. He was very pleased, as I recall, and I had a horse blow up with me and run off with me one time on a horse downhill.
Really?
Yeah. That scared the shit out of me, that one, because it was down through a really nasty piece of ground and through some big equipment. That could have been a bad wreck. That scared a lot of people, actually.
And nothing you said or did would stop the horse?
I was just cranking back on him. He was nuts. This horse was fucking nuts. And I wasn't smart enough to just turn him in a circle and get off of him. I am now.
But I would imagine you'd panic in that situation.
Yeah, I lost it. I was just trying to stay on. I stayed on.
God.
Well, some wrangler grabbed him and brought him up short, and, you know, anyway.
You know, Conagher is interesting. It sort of sticks out as an anomaly in your career in that you bought the Louis L'Amour rights to that book, and then you and Catherine ended up rewriting the script, right?
Yeah, we did the adaptation.
Okay.
Louis told me about that book when I went to pick Louis up at the airport to take him up to the set up in Patagonia when we were doing the Sacketts.
Okay.
I was fortunate that it fell to me to go pick Louis L'Amour up at the Tucson airport.
Yeah, that wouldn't happen today. They wouldn't send their lead actor to go pick up the...
No, lucky me. And on that ride, he asked me if I had ever read Conagher, because he knew I was with Catherine. He said, you and Catherine ought to do this thing. I optioned the book, and then we wrote the screenplay.
So that was sort of the first time you'd gone into that world, right?
First time I ever produced, first time we both wrote.
And was it...
was successful. It was the highest rated thing that TNT had ever produced at the time when it went on the air. It was very successful.
And what was that like?
I'll tell you, it was so much fun. Catherine and I, when we met on a picture called The Legacy in 1978, we worked on that script that we were both acting on at that time. And from the beginning, that was the beginning of our relationship. We were working on a script. And it was more fun. It's still today. I think Catherine and I love working on screenplays together.
What a great way to find your partner, right?
It's mind-boggling.
It sounds like all of your best things in life come from work, from getting down and rolling your sleeves up. And
yeah, good fortune and hard work. I do this thing for Coors, right? I do this voiceover for Coors.
Yeah.
They've got these old stubby bottles, I think, that were around in the 30s or whatever.
Oh, like the Red Stripe bottles.
Exactly. And they've got these little vignettes. You twist the top off, and there's a little message printed inside, and one of them is, get your hands dirty. It's about this whole work thing. And one of them says, good luck is the residual of hard work. So, yeah, you know, I believe that. I totally believe that. There's a certain amount that you have no control over, but hard work wins out in the end, I think.
Yeah.
If if you have good fortune. You got to have good fortune. You got to be lucky.
Well, I tell you, we haven't talked about the Coen brothers at all. And
which probably thrills them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so for anyone living under a rock for the last 20 years, you're in The Big Lebowski, and you play this very, very sage narrator that sits at a bar and has these odd conversations with Jeff Bridges. But there's a line in the film that's almost a Zen-type saying.
Sometimes you eat the bar, and sometimes, well, sometimes the bar eats you.
What does that line mean to you? When you had to say that line, like...
I just think it's sometimes one thing's one thing, and another time, and it's something else.
So you don't think when you're saying...
I don't think it has shit to do with a bar. Is it a bar? Is it a fucking... Is it the bar? Is it you sit down and get shit-faced and get up and walk away? Or is it you sit down and get shit-faced and crash on the bar? Or is it a bear?
Right.
Called a bar. That sometime you get away from it and sometime it stops you and eats you. This bridge, what does Bridges say? He says, what is that, some kind of Eastern thing?
And you say far from it,
friend.
I've always thought about that line.
I'm sure you have. And I'm sure a lot of people have.
And I don't have a good.
I don't have an answer at all. That was the one I've got. Yeah. I just gave you. I think it's sometimes one thing's one thing, sometimes it's another thing. I just played every bit of that as straight as I could, and as honest as I could, and made as much sense of it as I could, because I figured that's what they wanted me there for. And I know that if that's not what they wanted out of me, they would have told me.
Well, there's something to be said for the gravity of being able to say something in a way that just drips with meaning, even if the meaning is ambiguous.
Yeah.
That you have
the... It goes back to the scene with Offerman at the house, the rehearsal scene.
That's right.
Play it straight. Play it honest.
It seems like your career has been built on that simplicity.
Ben Johnson one time told me on the set of the Sacketts, we're just talking about his career, and, you know, he'd won an Academy Award, and, you know, he was just this guy that came out from Oklahoma with a load of horses with his dad, bring these horses out to work in the movie business. And one day was wrangling on a John Ford movie. I'm not going to try to guess which one it was, but was sitting on a horse when a stagecoach ran away, and it had the leading lady in it and a couple other actors coming downhill. And Ben stepped out in front of this thing on horseback and stopped this team. I mean, literally stopped it. He worked for John Ford forever after that, because Ford understood what kind of a man he was. And not only that, but understood what he could bring to his work. And slowly over the years, through all those John Wayne movies, you know, got to be a pretty credible actor. But what it was he said to me is, he said, you know, I may not be a very good actor, but nobody can play Ben Johnson better than I can. I always thought, wow, that's true of all those guys that I admire. That's true of Gary Cooper, was true of Jimmy Stewart, you know, all those guys. Nobody could play them better than they could. And they were all good actors. They were all good actors. You know, I hear this, you know, a lot of people, and I'm not going to defend that. I'm not saying, nobody's ever going to confuse me with a chameleon. One of those kind of actors.
I'm not one of those actors,
and I don't ever pretend to be. But I know that I'm honest, or try to be honest in my work. And those guys, those big guys out of that golden era of the movie business, nobody could play them like they did. And we used to go to see movies to see those guys play in the movies, and we didn't see them, you know. Oh, what are they going to create this week? I want to go see that guy in that situation, playing that character.
Right.
And that's what I do. I mean, it's like, you know, and some people might say, well, fuck, it's just the same old shit from Sam. And that's okay, too.
You know what I think of when I hear you say that? I think that there's not a lot of people that have lived enough of a life and developed themselves enough as a man or as a woman or whatever, mm-hmm. that we want to go see them film after film. And I feel like that's who you are as an actor.
Yeah.
And to get this film, to get the hero, and have it be a script written for you, that's got to be the ultimate culmination of that kind of thing. And it is true that I think one of the great joys of watching the hero is watching you...
do nothing.
Well, then that's probably what it seems like to you. But to me, it's watching you put your insides...
on the outside.
On outside, for us. And it's incredible. And, you know, I had a question, and you know, I'm comparatively young and inexperienced and naive compared to your life experience, but I just wondered if the material in this film and the fact that there's a retrospective quality to this character looking back at his life and dealing with morality and dealing with family issues, did it sort of force you to look at mortality in a more detailed way than perhaps you'd had to before?
Sure.
What comes up with that?
Trying to really set things straight that are most important, you know? The real value, and it's beyond career, it's more about people and people you dearly love, that you want to see them be okay. My daughter, I want to see Cleo be okay when I'm done, when I'm gone.
Yeah.
More than anything, that's what I want. I have a niece that I feel pretty much the same way about. I have a sister that's older than I am that I feel pretty much the same way about, certainly Catherine. I want to see the people I'm around okay.
And those things are certainly themes in the film.
Seems simple, but that's the truth of it. Because, you know, fuck, I mean, they've just dropped like flies this year for me, friends. I got so many people to thank, and most of them are gone for me sitting here with you right now. It's mind-boggling. So that's what mortality or what piques me when I think about, you know. And then I just think about good fortune, how fortunate I've been. In this world, in this climate that we're in today, to be sitting here with you talking about this movie, if I don't recognize how fortunate I've been, how blessed I've been, then I've gone about it all the wrong way.
Are you as old in your head as the age
no
that
way.
You physically
no
are?
No fucking way, buddy. No way. No way. Hopefully I'll never be that old.
I mean, do you feel like you have a lot left to do?
Yes.
That never changes, does it? If you're curious about life and if you like what you do.
Yeah, if you like life, if you enjoy life. I love life. I love people. I love acting.
I mean, are you a looking forward guy, or did this film make you look backward a little bit too?
I don't think it does any good to look back. You're not going backwards. Although it might seem like it sometimes, you know. What's left is ahead, it isn't behind you.
Well, listen, I could go on for hours.
Me
I feel
too.
Like
Me too.
I feel we like,
could like we could do like chapters, could be like Gone with the Wind or
yeah.
We could do a remake. We could just, you know, click cut this one and then do a remake.
It's great to talk to you.
It's such a pleasure for me too. I can see why Becca Kovacic loves your show.
Oh,
she's
well,
my manager, and she touted your show to me.
Well, I would like her to go out and tout it to everybody
the
else too. Yeah, yeah. But you know, I tell you, it's very touching to hear you talk about your dad and to lose him young and have him not see what you did, and to see that you carve this path that, like, you got to be you, and you're getting to be you. And like you say, it's there's no one better at being you than you. And how many people
it's
get that
so
opportunity?
It's so of all of us, isn't it?
Yeah.
Man, it's so of all of us. And I'm fortunate.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing everything.
Thank you, Samuel.
I appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did, and I hope some of Sam's words of wisdom will find their way into your own life. I guess we got no closer to figuring out the mystery of the bar eating you or you eating the bar, but if you have any ideas about it or any other thoughts on your mind, email me. I am sam@offcamera.com. You can find us on social media at Off Camera Show at both Twitter and Instagram. I'm Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor, writer, and comedian Kumail Nanjiani.
I come from a funny family, but I never felt funny until I came to America. Like, my family was shocked when I started doing stand-up because they were like, you're so shy, you're so quiet. And I was really shy. I really feel like I wasn't really a person. When I first started feeling funny, I remember being like, oh, I'm funny. This is part of who I am. And so that gave me a lot of confidence and really made me feel like a person.
He talks about coming to the U.S. from Pakistan, losing his identity, and finding comedy. First as a stand-up, and then on HBO's Silicon Valley. You'll also hear how his attempts to dodge an arranged marriage and the near-death experience of his girlfriend became The Big Sick, his surprisingly universal and funny new film. See you next time. Off camera.